This is Steve Kim. Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. Hello, world, wherever you're listening to this. Welcome to today's edition of the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim. Usually after our annual conference, there is a bit of a quiet hustle around the office because there are a lot of loose ends to tie up. And one of those things includes the video and audio recordings from the conference. So I've been in the thick of it. As the date of this recording, it should be coming out in just a few days. So just hang in there. But in the meantime, I thought we would bring you the audio recording from one of the breakout sessions. I think you'll find it very interesting. I won't need to do a whole lot of introductions on this because I do all of that in the recording. So if you couldn't make it to our conference or if you simply want to relive the experience, you can go to our website, apologeticscanada.com/store, and you'll be able to see all of the recordings from the past conferences and in just a few days' time, this year's conference as well. So without further ado, here's Jojo Ruba from Faith Beyond Belief. You're listening to We've Been There All Along, The Surprising History of Christians' Contribution to Canada's Political Life by Jojo Ruba. Jojo is the Executive Director of Faith Beyond Belief in Calgary, Alberta. This breakout session was recorded at the 2019 Apologetics Canada Conference on March 2nd at Northview Community Church in Abbotsford, British Columbia. For more resources, please visit us at apologeticscanada.com.
So everyone, thanks so much for being part of my session. There's some really great sessions out there, so I'm always respectful of those who wanted to come to hear me. My name is Jojo Ruba. I'm Executive Director of Faith Beyond Belief. We're actually a similar ministry to Apologetics Canada, but we're based in Alberta. So our big conference is actually happening next weekend. It's called the Be Ready Conference, and our theme there is Be Ready, Finding God in Science. So we have a science-based theme. We're excited for that. But I actually also have a background in journalism. My undergrad's in journalism from Carleton University, which is the best journalism school in Canada, I've heard. Apparently, Carleton, however, which is spelled C-A-R-L-E-T-O-N, has a motto that says something like, Carleton, where the K stands for quality, because we're not really known for any other kind of program. I love Carleton. It's great. It's good. You got it. I also have a master's degree in political science, and I only share that not to boast, but to simply say I love politics. I love talking about it. And I really am so blessed and impressed by Apologetics Canada to host this kind of conference. So bringing those two worlds together. In fact, one of my best friends in high school, she was a hardcore NDP, and I was not. I won't say what it was. And what we connected, even though we had opposite polar extremes, because we love politics together. And we were great friends in high school. So whatever your political background is, I'm glad you're here, because it's important for us to know where we're coming from as a country. We've come to a point where smart, intelligent people do not understand the role of religion and politics, and there's a big confusion about that. Let me illustrate. I have a friend. She's actually become a friend. Her name is Christine Shelska. She was actually head of the Atheist Alliance International, the National Alliance Organization for Atheists in Canada. She's the first Canadian to sit on the Humanist Association of the United States on their board. Right, so she's pretty high up. And so she should know a lot of things. In fact, she's doing her dissertation in communications, and get this, on the manipulative techniques of young earth creationists. And I'm paraphrasing. And when she met me, she added the manipulative techniques of young earth creationists and Christian apologists. So that was her new dissertation there. So I'm glad to be an influence in her life. Right. So when we did our first debate in public, this is what her first statement was. Jojo Ruba wants to create a Christian theocratic state where he imposes his evangelical values on everybody else. I'm like, wait a second, I didn't put that on my website. Where did you get that idea from? But it's such a cachet idea. It's so popular in her circles, she just took it for granted. And so how is it that a smart, intelligent woman who speaks at the United Nations can have such a false idea? Where did we come to this point where this is actually now something that's commonplace? And so I want today to walk through three epochs of time, I think, in Canadian history to explain how we got here. I want to explain that, again, my background is communication, so I'm not going to go through the law. I'm not that familiar with a lot of the law. We actually had to take a class in journalism school called media law. It was half the students were journalism students, the other half were law students, and we would never agree on anything. You can really tell the journalism students were always wanting to push free speech. The law students would always want to push restrictions on that free speech, and we couldn't discuss stuff. But here's something about politics. We have to take both in consideration. So if you want to study politics or political science, you want to be able to look both at how law works and how it's communicated. And so I want to give you three epochs of time where these kinds of legislations or regulations are being communicated and the values that inform them. All right? And so I want to ask a question that I actually was asked in my first class in political science in university. And I want you to think about the implications of the question, because the question actually leads to our understanding, or helps us understand the parameters of what we're dealing with. Okay? So find a partner, talk this out, or a group of people. Here's the question. Is politics science? We call it political science, right? Again, this is first year university, first class. Is politics science? Go ahead, to have a conversation. Okay, everyone, let's come back. All right, so what do we need to know in order to answer this question?
What is science?
Ah, yes, very good. 10 points. Very good. So what is science? What do we mean by when we say science?
We're talking the scientific method.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, scientific, well, you can't use a definition, the same word in a definition. So you have to explain, what do you mean by scientific method?
Well, the scientific method is presenting a hypothesis, designing an experiment, and then carrying out your experiment to either refute or agree with your hypothesis.
Excellent. So is politics science?
No.
Why?
I'm science.
Okay, yeah. Why not?
Well, I would say it's not a science, but it uses science, is what
okay.
I mean. Politics, where science has the cold hard facts kind of thing, and you're observing and then making your judgments based on those observations. Politics is more you do observe what people like, but it shifts and it changes, and there's no sort of baseline if we can always go back to this.
Oh, I like that. Okay, that's good. I want to come back to that idea, okay, because that's really important what you just said. Okay, very good. Yeah, over here.
I would actually add to science. There is the experimental science.
Yes.
Forensic type of science.
Yes.
In which you cannot duplicate. You cannot do this into a lab. Forensic science includes things like history, and of course, what detectives do.
Observation, is that fair to say?
Includes things like geology and archaeology, because you have to look at the evidence from something historical. So both of those are disciplines in which you bring about a hypothesis.
Very good.
And seek to find evidence, either through experiment or through examination.
Great.
Is politics
science? That's the question.
Either one of those. And I would argue that political science is a discipline in which part of what you do is you look into the past. You have to look into the past and see what people have done with different systems and what kind of results they have had.
Absolutely.
Historically, I would say that part of politics I would call.
Ah, so we have a little nuanced answer here. Very good. Over here, one more. Yeah.
I'm thinking the two other aspects of the research method.
Yes.
The descriptive research.
Yes, absolutely.
So there's a protocol that you follow.
Of course.
To observe behavior and come up with observations in terms of the basic research.
Yes.
Which you could probably use in applied format.
Of course.
There's also correlational research that could be useful. And also follow a regiment or a structure. And so, those two methods seems to be better fitted into the evaluation of politics.
Oh, absolutely.
And trying to put politics into a science lab.
Right. Okay. Very good. We'll take one more. Go ahead, ma'am.
Yes, that's my answer.
That's your answer. Very good. You see, when we think about politics, those are all very good answers. Here's our challenge, right? The origin of the word politics is polis, and I know you can't see it here, but it's about the city-state or the people of the city-state. And what politics was concerned about was how to govern, how to rule a city-state, and here's the point, for its benefit. What was the common good that would benefit everyone in that city-state? And the challenge we have when we ask the question, is politics science, is the question is common good objective? Are there objective ways for us to get to this point? Or is this only subjective? Is it something that in terms of measurements, can we measure the health of a city, the population growth? Those are all objective things. But is there a moral good that's objective that we can point to? You see where I'm heading in this discussion, right?
Is it a social construct?
Exactly. Right. And so in terms of excellent point. In terms of our epics and time, I actually want to go back to this because how religion and politics interact is based on what we consider the common good and whether we consider it objective or subjective. And here's what I mean. So when we talk about Canada, for example, anyone recognize what this is? The coat of arms, exactly. Does anyone know what the saying is on the bottom?
From sea to sea.
Exactly. Where is that from?
It's Latin.
Yes. Yeah. Good. So start. The Bible, exactly. When we go from sea to sea, it's actually from Psalm 72:8. He shall have dominion also from sea to sea. And that's why Canada was known as Dominion of Canada. And we didn't have Canada Day for the longest time. We had Dominion Day. Exactly. And when we consider what that means, the Bible is not saying that God will take away your freedom of choice or impose a Christian monotheistic worldview on you. What he's saying is this is his reality. This is his world.
Is that what Calgary looks like today?
Oh, are you trying to tease me? It's probably worse, actually. Yeah. So one of my favorite writers and speakers, Greg Kokel, says this way. He wrote a book called The Story of Reality. I heard someone mention it. It's one of my, I think this is a great book to read. And I love how he says it. He says, look, the story of reality for a Christian is this. God, who made humanity, but humanity fell. And so he had to send Jesus to die on a cross. So one day we will have a new resurrection in life. God, humanity, Jesus, cross, and resurrection. And he says, if you're a Christian, this is your story of reality. But I love this part. He says, if you're not a Christian, this is still your story of reality. Because there's only one reality. That's all it's saying here. And I think we need to come back to that because this concept of Christianity is a worldview, a way of understanding all of reality is something in the church we don't even understand ourselves, especially nowadays. And as we're moving through the political arena, this concept is becoming more and more obscure. We need to recognize we have something here. And here's the point, too. And I want to come back to this as we talk about this. But the Christian worldview then offers something good, the common good, the public good, for everyone to benefit from. It is not this mindset we want to impose this religious theocracy on you. This is not The Handmaid's Tale, which was a pretty bad book when I read it in the 80s, and now it's a movie and a television series. And it's gotten worse in terms of its views of Christianity. So let me give you the titles of these three epics. So the first is we had a time in Canada when it started where faith was public. It was viewed as part of the common good. It contributed to common good. When we go back to, for example, John A. Macdonald, as flawed as a character as he is, we can talk about his history later, whether or not we remove his statues. Right? We'll come to that later. Okay, John A. Macdonald, what he had to do to begin to start this country was unite two factions who had different religious perspectives, one Catholic and one Protestant. And they were viewed that way. It wasn't through their language, it was through their faith. Their lens was through their church. And in order to bring them together, he had to find a common good that they could all unite around. That's how Canada started, right? And we know this because the legislation we have on public and private schools, for example, was first divided by Catholic and Protestant schools. That was enshrined in the Constitution. That's how important religious identity was. It was assumed it was part of the common good, right? And we talk about what the church was able to do. There's an article that I looked at that talked about how churches would help new immigrants. They would come in and help people like these boys. These are called the Mining Boys of Canada in New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, where they would, boys as young as 8 or 9 years old would actually work in the mines. And churches would provide resources and help for these people to provide the social services the government could not afford, because they weren't able to do that. And in fact, what's interesting was when we look at what was available at the time, it was churches who provided this kind of common good resource. This person here, Abby Thompson, is a Salvation Army member. At 19 years old, she was getting 12,000 or so people to listen to her speak. As she's sharing. And it was so popular, a local soap company named a soap bar after her to take advantage of how popular she was. Right? Because everyone knew the church did good things for the public. And they recognized it as a common good, a public good. In fact, when, of course, the tax man came, which they always do, the tax debate and discussion at the time of Canada becoming a country was whether or not Toronto and Montreal would tax the property of churches. Okay, so that was a debate in both cities. And in particular in Quebec, the Catholic groups were all against it. Why? Because the churches already provide for the common good. Right? And imagine, this is from La Presse, so I don't think La Presse would ever print this today. Who will deny that here the exemption of churches from taxation does not equally benefit everyone? The whole population have religious beliefs and are frequenters of the temple of God. Do we want to tax educational institutions? On the contrary, we tax ourselves for the maintenance of these institutions. So they defended the right of churches not to be taxed because they provided for the common good. In Protestant English-speaking Canada, this is actually, this debate was more intense, but no one said that the churches don't do good work. Everyone recognized it. In fact, in terms of those laws, I don't think they ever taxed church property at that time, especially in Montreal. And as we went into the 30s, the dirty 30s particularly, when all kinds of social ills were going on, the dirty 30s, it was a guy named J.S. Woodsworth. Does anyone know what his job was before he became a politician? He was a Methodist pastor who started a group called the CCF, which, of course, as you know, is the forefounder of the NDP, started by a religious guy. A pastor, in fact, who wanted to bring good social justice into the public arena and bring good public policy. Again, you don't have to agree with these policies. All I'm making the point is, in terms of our history, it was Christians who contributed to the common good. And the guy who came after was a guy named Pastor Tommy Douglas, who was a Baptist pastor, who started another party based on the CCF called the NDP. Again, because he wanted to bring Christian values into the public sphere. You see how alien that sounds now? So every time you go to the hospital and get free health care, guess what? You can thank a Baptist pastor. You can tell your secular friends that, by the way. They probably don't even know that. In fact, I actually was talking to a Christian candidate running for as MLA in Alberta. He's a pastor. And I asked him, do you know who Tommy Douglas was? And he said, no. So let alone the fact that we have such a Christian history for many of the social institutions available to us. This is what I mean. So in terms of this vacuum, not knowing our history actually removes the fact that Christians have always been there contributing to the common good. Right? Now, I'm from Alberta now. I've been there for about 10 years. And so we have a guy named Bible Bill Eberhardt, who was a premier in 1935. And whether or not you agree with him, again, that's okay. He brought a party called the Social Credit Party. You guys had it here for a bit as well. Social credit's values at the time was based on principles in the Old Testament that did not want us to get to charge interest. Right? That was one of the laws in the Old Testament law. And so Bible Bill, as a Bible preacher on the radio, moved from Bible preaching on the radio to becoming premier. Imagine that happening today. I can't even imagine that happening today. It's never going to happen again, right? Why? Because back then, the Christian church was seen as contributing to something good for everybody. Right? That's the challenge. So what happened? So now we move into a sphere, as we begin to go to the 60s, after the World Wars, of faith as a private thing. And in fact, if you've never read the book, I'm listening to the audiobook right now. Nancy Pierce's book called Total Truth explains this extremely well, very succinct way. She explains how from the Enlightenment, we've moved from a stage where we have divided values and facts. And this is what she means. On the top story, the above the line, values include things like morality, like religion. These kinds of things are true for you. These are your preferences. These are your beliefs that are in the private sphere. On the bottom are facts. Facts, things like science, things like geography, geology, mathematics, taxation, and government. You see what's happened here? So, and as she explains it really well, as the ideas of government and religion progress, they add new ideas to it. So at the start, these were seen as equals. Today, they're actually seen as enemies. Or even worse, the top value is not even important. Because it's subjective, we begin to see how fact encompasses everything. And what's key in the 1960s, particularly in Canada, we have this mindset that things have to be maintained in the private sphere, like beliefs and religion, because the public sphere is taking care of it. And because the public sphere is based on facts rather than values, this is what's neutral. This is not. One of the best examples for us here in Canada was the Quiet Revolution in the 1960s. And here's what happened. We know a lot about how the church fell from grace or was not. Basically, the church membership plummeted at that time. Here's something else that I didn't realize. Right? At this time, this is also the time when the Quebec government took over many of the social services the church was responsible for. Education, hospitals, health, all kinds of social services now became part of the public sphere, not the private one. And when René Lévesque was elected in 1960 as part of the Sovereigntist party, one of the key things he did as a movement was move from identifying your nationality based on your religion to your nationality based on your language. And so religion can now be left in the private sphere. It no longer has to be part of your identity. You see where this is going? And when we have this kind of conversation, of course, the man who epitomizes this is a guy named Pierre Trudeau. And Pierre Trudeau, actually this is the 50th anniversary of it, passed a bill called the Omnibus Bill. The Omnibus Bill legalized homosexuality, birth control, and abortion in 1969. And he passed it as an omnibus bill because he knew some of his own MPs at the time were opposed to birth control but were okay with legalizing homosexuality, or opposed to abortion but were okay with legalizing birth control. So he put them all together in one giant bill to get it passed all at once. And when he was asked why he did this, why he was trying to liberalize these laws, this is what he said.
It's bringing the laws of the land up to contemporary society, I think. Take this thing on homosexuality. I think the view we take here is that there's no place for the state in the bedrooms of the nation, and I think that what's done in private between adults doesn't concern the criminal code. When it becomes public, this is a different matter.
You see what he's done there? He's made a very clear line, hasn't he? What's done in private between adults is not having anything to do with the state. It's only when it becomes public do we have to deal with it as a state. Now, I don't know if that's true. That's the problem. Here's the thing. Go back to your house and look up your mattress and see if there's a tag there. What does that tag say on your mattress? Do not remove this tag upon pain of death, right? The government's going to come after you. So wait a second. I thought the state had no role in the bedrooms of the nation. What's it doing there? In fact, throughout your house are all kinds of government regulations that exist. You see the problem? And when we have this kind of mindset that certain kinds of things should stay in the private sphere, then we have a generation of people now who are being taught that there's a difference. Now remember what I said about Christian worldview. The Christian worldview says everything belongs to Jesus. This mindset says, no, it's separate. You have to separate these realities. And by the way, we're going to recognize certain realities and tell you if you have an opinion about other realities, you have to keep it to yourself. That's what's happened. So when Trudeau came in with a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, nationalized our Constitution, there are a lot of great things in the Charter, but one of the emphasis of the Charter of Rights was there are certain rights that are public that are guaranteed by the government. But there are also things that you ought to keep private. And that came through in the 1988 decision on the abortion by the Morgenthaler decision. And the Morgenthaler decision directly quotes the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, saying abortion is a private right, even though the Charter doesn't actually say that. But the assumption is just because it's private, you can no longer have a public opinion about it. And that's what we began to see in the change of the law. In fact, when the Supreme Court made this decision, I was actually already starting to get involved in pro-life work at the time. I realized there was a big shift, and this confirmed to me later on. Many pro-life activists of the day, when they tried to make a new law in 1989, and it got defeated by one vote in the Senate, the unelected body got to defeat a law passed by the elected body. Think about that in Canada. I actually was on a tour when I was first a student in Ottawa, and the tour guide of the Senate actually got me through the Senate and our tour group, and he said, with no at all apology, how proud he was of the Senate to defeat an elected bill from the government, from the elected House of Commons. And he said it as if everyone agreed with him. It was a wonderful thing. What happened, though, and this is what's key, especially from the evangelical side of things, who were involved in the pro-life movement at the time, many of them got so discouraged by that, they began to adopt the worldview that their private beliefs on abortion or the right to life or faith should stay private and not be made public. And they stopped being involved in public policy. And that's, I think, the trend that we see. So when we got into the debate on same-sex marriage or now transgender rights, a lot of the Christians no longer wanted to get involved because we stayed in our private sphere. We enforced this idea. When we talk about the Charter of Rights, by the way, if you know, there's actually a preamble to it, right? Does anyone know what the preamble says? So at the very start of this charter, it says, whereas Canada is founded upon principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law. Notice that? So Trudeau actually put that in there as a concession because he has to. He has to explain where rights come from. If human rights are objective, then they can't just come from our society. They have to come from somewhere else in order for us to say, you can't do this. You can't harm people. But I got this slide, and I'm sorry, I forgot to reference this one. But look what she says here. This is supposed to set the context for the rest of the charter. However, it is referred to as the embarrassing preamble and is ignored by lawyers and judges. So now they can read into rights into the Constitution, like transgender rights. Right? Again, I'm not attacking transgender people or talking about that legislation. I'm simply saying that's what's been done. Okay, that's how the law is now being interpreted, because we're no longer talking about a common good that religious people can be part of. You see that? But what's interesting is a guy from my hometown, Winnipeg, Bill Blakey, was a United Church pastor before he became an NDP member of Parliament. He actually ran against Jack Layton and came in second. And Bill Blakey was known as a very strong moderate in the NDP party because he actually supported religious liberties. He, whether or not again you agree with him, he actually stood out and spoke many times as part of the prayer breakfast in Ottawa, from what I understand when I was there. He was heavily involved in the Christian community. How many MPs, NDP MPs, do you think are involved now? And that's the challenge. Because we have put faith in such a private sphere, we have taken all of these other issues and completely regulated these beliefs to say they don't have anything to say about public policy. So where is that? Where does that lead us? Well, this is supposed to be parody from a TV show I love from the CBC called The Air Farce. And this is parody 25 years ago. Okay, so think about that.
Today, we have the story of a very special holy day that has come to be known to religious people throughout the world as the day before Boxing Day. Many years ago, in a faraway place called Bethlehem, there were two young significant others searching for a temporary multi-room paid accommodation dwelling. The husband was a womb disadvantaged person who toiled as a woodworking technician. The wife was an unsalaried home caregiver who, thanks to an interpersonal relationship with the non-denominational supreme being, had become virginally challenged. in an immaculate kind of way. The two spouses could not find lodging, so they had to sleep in a government-assisted public housing situation, along with other barnyard non-humans. And on this particular night, there was born unto this couple a gender non-specific offspring. Joy spread quickly to a nearby shepherd as he or she watched over his or her flock of potential sweater providers. And the gender non-specific offspring was visited by a trio of intelligent persons who brought gold, frankincense, and their friend Murray. Murray followed an alternate lifestyle, which in no way diminished his worth as a human person. The couple was grateful, although they really could have used an infant car seat and some Huggies. And that's our story. Have yourself a happy, non-specific, seasonally correct, interdenominational, pseudo-holiday festive occasion.
Now, that was parody 25 years ago. Would that even be shown on the CBC today? Or the CTV or whatever? Probably not. Why is that? Because we've come to a point where truth no longer matters when it comes to public policy. And I say that very carefully, because people still believe that they believe in truth. But if you listen to the conversations, what's more important now is how people feel about those truths. And how we feel about those truths becomes such a primary idea, because we've thrown out this concept of an objective common good. Good is now relative. And relative to what? To how we feel. You see how that flows? So, I use the word very carefully. I was going to put it in quotes, but I thought I'd just leave it up there, because that's the result. We have now moved from a public private, to now a open persecution of faith in Canada, which is what we're talking about upstairs. And I, again, I'm not trying to demonize anybody. This is just the reality of where we're at. Okay. Let me show you a picture. This is from the Alberta Pro-Choice Coalition Facebook group, which I'm part of all of these groups, so it doesn't mean I endorse these values. I just want to let you know, right? And they posted a story about how the United Conservative Party leader has a staffer, a former staffer, who's working to elect pro-life candidates as part of the party, which, by the way, every organization that works in politics is trying to elect people who agree with them, right? It's not a surprise. The comments underneath included this one. The bottom, it says, why is this even allowed? And this is the debate, by the way, that this being put on in groups like this all the time. I'm part of an anti-racist, Calgary anti-racist group. And part of one of the debates they had there was whether or not we should kill Nazis. And guess who gets to determine who's a Nazi? They do. Right? And this is the challenge. Again, I'm not trying to demonize. This is just our reality. And as if we've come to a point where people's feelings determine what we ought to do publicly, then that means the most sensitive person in the room gets to determine what everyone else gets to say. And we're in trouble if that's the case. Because it's no longer objective facts that we have in science. Now it's our feelings that determine it. By the way, you can never escape facts. That's the reality of it. That's what we call it, facts. Right? If you go online, for example, you look for a t-shirt. The t-shirt says, there are more than two genders. You can buy it on Amazon or wherever. When you buy the t-shirt that says there are more than two genders, you can only buy it in male and female sizes. Why is that? Because it doesn't matter what you believe, facts have a way of biting back. This is the Minister of Employment at the time, who was responsible for the summer student program that Rachel Harder was speaking about upstairs. And I want you to listen to what she says when she was asked by this global reporter, so not a Christian, about whether or not she and her government are going to restrict other freedoms for Christians and other pro-life people, or if they're going to add other attestations, other things we have to agree with before we access government services. And by the way, it's not just summer student funding. This is what she says, okay?
The government recently announced controversial changes to the Canada Summer Jobs Program, which prompted backlash from religious leaders who call it a values test. The change calls for employers hiring students over the summer to attest that their organization's mandate respects human rights, the charter, and specifically women's reproductive rights. So why the changes and where do they end? And joining me now from Thunder Bay, Ontario, is Employment Minister Patty Hajdu. Thanks for being with us, Minister. I wanted to start off by asking, why does your government feel it was necessary to add that attestation box as a requirement before organizations can qualify to receive money to hire students for the summer?
Well, the Canada Summer Jobs Program is really designed to address the need for young Canadians to, first of all, earn a bit of money in between periods of study, but secondly, and maybe even more importantly, to gain that great job experience that will move them forward in their careers, whether it's identifying a career path or gaining those soft skills that our employers are looking for. And we know that those quality job experiences should be with organizations that have a respect for the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and other fundamental rights of Canadians.
But religious groups see it as a threat to their freedom of religion and their ability to even hire summer students. What do you say to them?
The way that the attestation is written is that the organization's core mandate and the job description have to respect the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and other fundamental rights. And so the majority of organizations in this country should have no problem attesting that their core mandate does in fact respect the Charter. And, you know, we are profoundly grateful and work very closely with faith-based groups across the country and know the great work that they do. And so we know that this attestation will not invalidate most groups in the country.
What about a camp, though, run by a Catholic church? The church is not pro-choice. Will they no longer qualify for any federal funding?
Organizations have a variety of mandates, and faith-based groups also have a variety of mandates. And the mandates usually specify, for example, for a faith-based organization like the Catholic Church, it may specify, you know, spreading the word of God or of Christ. Other faith-based organizations have mandates that are around alleviating suffering or addressing poverty. And so, again, there are many beliefs and values that go into an organization, but the organization's mandate and the job description is what we're most interested in.
But some organizations say they won't be able to sign off on the attestation because it conflicts with their beliefs.
Each organization is going to have to make a decision based on their own comfort level. But what I can tell you is that this attestation is written in a way that specifically addresses the mandate of the organization and the job description. You know, mandates are generally broad statements of purpose. And obviously, many different beliefs and values go into an organization. And sometimes there's conflicting beliefs and values in an organization. And that's why it's specifically written to address an organization's mandate. I can tell you, as a former not-for-profit organization executive director, we had a mandate that was about alleviating poverty and providing shelter to those, to everyone. We believed that shelter was a fundamental right. That didn't mean that necessarily everyone that worked for the organization or even, you know, members of the board agreed about how to achieve that mandate. And there were often, you know, heated arguments about how we move forward with this mandate and how we deliver on our mandate. Those are normal conversations that happen within organizations. A mandate is a specific statement of purpose, and a job description, of course, clearly specifies what the job would be.
It seems conflicting to me.
I don't think there's anything conflicting in the statement that an organization's primary mandate and that the job description respect the Charter of Rights and other fundamental rights that Canadians have. What we're trying to make sure is that these jobs for young people are in experiences that are respectful of the rights that Canadians have and that they gain the kinds of experiences in a non-discriminatory way. And so this is the kind of attestation that we've designed to address that, to make sure that organizations that are applying for this grant, which, by the way, organizations have to apply for every year, you know, that their organization's mandate and job description respect the Charter.
Do you see extending these attestations to other areas in the future?
At this point, my responsibility is for the Canada Summer Jobs Program, and so we're focused right now on the unrolling of the Canada Summer Jobs Program.
But I just want to be clear here. Are you ruling out adding the attestation box to other government employment programs?
I would say that, you know, when we're delivering funding for programs through the Canadian government, we need to be reflective of the rights that Canadians have and the right for Canadians to, you know, to experience you know, whether it's employment experiences in a non-discriminatory way.
But again, will you extend it to other programs?
Right now, my focus is Canada Summer Jobs.
What about adding other attestations? For example, will groups have to sign off on doctor-assisted death?
You know, right now, the attestation, we're very comfortable with where the attestation stands. As I said, this is about ensuring that an organization's core mandate and the job description, complies with the charter and other fundamental rights. And what I can say is that, you know, employers, by and large, should have no problem with the attestation, because, in fact, mandates of organizations generally do comply. And so we're really looking forward to the launch of Canada Summer Jobs. Employers have till February 2nd to apply, and we anticipate that we'll have a similar demand by employers and, in fact, students. You know, there were a number of employers that we couldn't grant requests to last year simply because of demand, and that's good news for young Canadians.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much, Minister.
You too. Take care. Thank you.
Do you notice what she didn't say? Right? There was no limit to what they can do, and they're not willing to commit to stop it. Why? Because your private religious beliefs should stay private. Now, what's interesting is the Globe and Mail was radically pro-choice, pro-abortion. Actually, and the Toronto Star even, I think, wrote editorial saying this is the first time ever that Canada, the Canadian government has put a values test for any Canadian to access government services that every other taxpayer can get. And we have to see the gravity of it. She doesn't. She doesn't understand that. And I think it goes to the fact that we're moving to a model where not only is the private sphere the place of religion, your private religious beliefs now have to conform to public beliefs if you want to be part of the public. Because if you think this is going to stop with summer student grants, how about the fact that pro-choice movement right now, one of their biggest goals is to make sure that anyone who goes into the medical field has to be pro-choice or pro-euthanasia, or pro-transitioning 14-year-old girls without their parents' permission, which is what the BC Supreme Court just ruled this week. Right? And I cite those issues because those are the hot-button issues right now. But here's something that Greg Kokol said. It's really key. He said, these issues are merely the starting point. They're just the place where people begin, but the real battle is whether or not religious beliefs like Jesus is the only way and everybody who doesn't believe in him but will not go to the Father is allowed in the public sphere. And ladies and gentlemen, that's already happening in Alberta. In Alberta, we work with several Christian schools, and they were given what's called the Rainbow Mandate or Rainbow Reprimand. And what the government did was they went through the statement of faith and code of conduct of all the Christian schools. And by the way, this includes Christian schools that don't have to get public funding. So this is both private and public. All schools in Alberta have to go through this now, where their statement of faith has to agree with what the government teaches. So it has nothing to do with public funding. And each of these points here, each of these colors, refers to violations that the school has in their constitution or their charter or their statement of faith. I want you to highlight the yellow one. It's the easiest one to read anyway. Provisions contain language which suggests alternative viewpoints are not equally legitimate, which is disrespectful of diversity and thus inconsistent with sections 45.1, 4A.I. Okay? So one of the Christian schools got this back. This is what their statement of faith says. And look what's highlighted. The unchangeable and infallible truth of the Word of God. So the Christian schools can no longer teach that their worldview is true without violating what the government considers parts of the School Act in Alberta. And in fact, one Christian school had to go through with a government official about which Bible verses her school was allowed to use and which Bible verses her school was not allowed to use. This is not science fiction. This is reality in Canada. So if we don't understand the status of faith and politics in our culture, we're going to let these people and let these ideas, more importantly, take control, and then they'll be the ones educating our young people even more. So the question is, how do we respond? What is it that we ought to do? And how much time do I have left? Am I almost done? Should I hit the 5-minute mark already?
You have 2 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So I didn't get a chance to do this in the other group, but I think this is key. From a communication standpoint, who is familiar with the term silos of information? Anyone know what that means? Okay, so it's a common phrase in business. It actually started there. And silos of information means that in a business, say a McDonald's, Starbucks, big corporations, GM, right? There are so many departments that often these departments, even though they're part of the same company, don't talk to each other. So the finance department, the communications department, the logistics department, they speak different languages. And so what they want to do is have these groups talk to each other so they're more uniform in how business acts. But this is now applied to society and communication. And what we've observed is different groups have different silos in our community. Right, so each of these silos then become a way for us to help understand our culture, what's going on. Why? Because there's so much information. The challenge for nowadays is not that we can't find enough information. The challenge is there's so many sources of information, we need some help navigating through it. And so what we do is we go to our trusted sources from our communities, whether it's our LGBT group or Fox News or CNN, and that becomes our information gatherer for us. So we don't have time. And we have a situation where we trust these people so much that we mediate, we understand reality through their lens. I was speaking actually at the University of Victoria a few years ago, and I was doing a pro-life presentation, and there was a whole bunch of abortion advocates who wanted to protest us, and they actually sat right at eye level. So they could ask the first question. And during Q&A time, one of the young men raised his hand and he said, "You must oppose birth control because you're pro-life." And actually, I don't personally, but the organization I represent didn't take a stand on birth control. So I tried to explain that we're here to talk about abortion today, not on birth control. He refused to believe me because he'd been so indoctrinated by his group, by his silo, that even if he was talking to someone directly responsible for an organization that he was opposed to, he would not believe what I was saying at that point. His silo had informed him. But here's where I would add something more important in Canada. We don't have silos of information. I think the slides are not horizontal but vertical. And in fact, I think we have a caste system, like in India, where there are certain castes that have more sway and other castes that don't. Right? There's an untouchable caste, if you're familiar with the term, where the untouchables are so untouchable that people in the higher caste don't even let their shadow touch them. That's how untouchable they are. Guess where I think Christians are? At least my perspective. So we're in a situation where people don't even want to talk to us. And I've talked to many people who say, I have a coworker who won't even approach me because she thinks I'm homophobic. Because she knows I'm a Christian. So she won't even work with me, she won't even talk to me. And there's several people who've told me that, and I see that as a trend in the government. So what do we need to do? Well, it goes back to what Scripture says. Right, 2 Corinthians 5:20 says, "We are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were making an appeal directly through us. We beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God." And here's what ambassadors are. It's our job to go out of our silo to talk to people in other silos, to translate what we believe. In fact, the word Christian was first used in a city called Antioch because it was a place where people segregated themselves by race and religion. And when they became Christians, they came from all groups. So they had to get a new name. That's what Christian was. And here's the point with ambassador. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're an ambassador 24/7. It's not an option. There's no choice that you represent Jesus everywhere you go. The problem is sometimes we represent Jesus everywhere we go, right? Again, Greg Kokel says there's two reasons why people don't become Christians. The first reason is because they don't know any Christians. The second is because they know too many. Right? You know what I mean, right? So if we recognize that's the key, I think the power is right there. God gave us opportunities in everyday conversations, everyday life, to be his ambassador. In fact, one of the things that we realize as a ministry, and that's, by the way, the motto of our organization, to equip Christians to be effective ambassadors for Christ for everyday conversations, is that the early church didn't have the tools we have today. It was a historian named Larry Hurtado who said this. He said, look, they grew despite the fact they had no comfy pews and wonderful music bands. Why did they grow? In fact, they were persecuted. Well, they only had two things. They had the love of Christ modeled in everyday life and the trustworthiness of the eyewitnesses who claimed to see Jesus. And guess what? That's what we still have today. And we can share those just like they did in everyday life and everyday conversations. And I want to encourage you, the job is not done yet. Yeah, it's hard. It's very difficult at this point. And we're in a big situation where we might not even be legally allowed to share the gospel in the next 20 years. And I'm not saying that to be extreme. I'm just saying that's probably reality. But that means we have opportunities, just like the early church, to be those ambassadors. So let me give you one last example, and then I'm done. You know that debate I did with Christine Shelska? Like I said, she's become a friend. We've debated her regularly. And one of the debates at the University of Calgary, it was in a class called Atheism 101. So most of the students were not friendly to me. Let's just say it that way, okay? And during Q&A time, one of the students raised her hand, and she said, after she heard Christine give her presentation on atheism, she said, look, it's obvious the more educated you are, the less religious you become. And everyone in the room basically just took it as fact. And so I got a chance to present in the next class, and I was like, God, what do I say to these people? How do I reach them? And I prayed about it and thought about it, and I went to the university's website and found this. This is University of Calgary's shield. Right, you notice it too has a motto, and the motto is actually put on an arch that they show that it's right in the middle of campus, right? And it's actually a translation from Welsh Gaelic. You know what it actually says in Gaelic? Gaelic, I will lift up my eyes. And where do you think that's from? Well, Psalms 121, verse 1. I will lift up my eyes to the mountains. From where shall my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. And in that class, ladies and gentlemen, I was able to present this very motto to those university students and ask them a question. If you think educated people can't be religious, why do you go to an institution that has a Bible verse as its motto? Dead silence. In fact, during Q&A time, it was great. Almost all the questions were for Christine, not for me. Because he had never heard a rational defense of the Christian worldview that made sense to them. And it was powerful because all the points I raised, they were asking of her, because she never was able to answer those points. So I want to encourage you, this is not a time to despair. This is a time to do work, to be ambassadors for Christ, because guess what? That's what Jesus was willing to do for us, to be the messenger that God sent so we can find hope and salvation. And I hope you realize at the end of the day, yeah, politics is not going to save us, but we have an opportunity to speak truth and find the key part, a common good. Christians can still share the gospel because it's still good news. And we need to help remind ourselves that that's why we have to participate in the public sphere. Let me just pray for you. Lord, thank you so much for Jesus. Thank you so much for your love for us. And thank you for calling us for such a time as this in this great country. Lord, we pray for Canada. And we pray, Lord, that we remember that the enemies are not people. They're ideas. They're spiritual forces. And right now, they're very powerful and have blinded so many people, like our prime minister, like our leaders. We pray for them like you've commanded us to, Lord, for wisdom, that their eyes may be opened. And then they may see that the church, Christians are not the enemy. We're here to provide goodness and to represent you in a culture that needs you so desperately. Help us, Lord, to be good ambassadors for Christ in everyday life. And we pray this in your Son's name. Amen. Amen. Thanks, everyone.